You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on Monster Talk, we talk with Dr. Brian Regal about his new book, Searching for Sasquatch, Crackpots, Eggheads, and Cryptozoology. It's an academic book about the history of the search for Sasquatch, yet not about Sasquatch. I like the book, and I enjoyed the interview. I hope you do too. But it does talk a lot about topics that monster hunters might find depressing. Is cryptozoology a pseudoscience? Is it a waste of time? Does real science care about monsters? Does science suppress the secret existence of mystery apes? Or has it simply withdrawn from the quest, smarting from hoax after hoax, but secretly hoping that someday the beast's corpse will hit the lab table? Tune in and find out.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford of Skeptical Inquirer magazine and Dr. Kieran Stolzno, a CSI research fellow and paranormal investigator, we examine monsters and their place in science and legend. In a moment, we'll hear an interview with Dr. Brian Regal. But first, I wanted to take a moment and talk about a few things that are going on with the show. Scheduling and running this show is a lot of work, but it's work I find immensely rewarding. We may be experimenting with the format a bit in the future, and you may hear some new voices behind the interview mics. It's my goal to keep the show fresh and to work hard to get more shows out per year. I've got some very interesting guests lined up and some thought-provoking topics. I do hope you'll enjoy the many things we're going to try and that you'll let us know what you like and what you don't like. We try to be accessible, and on internet forums, Twitter, Facebook, and email, we try to respond to your feedback. We hope you will give our Facebook fan page a try. There you can find out what's happening between episodes, plus meet lots of other listeners and join them in complaining about the ridiculously random schedule of Monster Talk. Also, you can find out where our next public appearances will be, such as the upcoming Monster Investigations Workshop we'll be hosting at the Amazing Meeting in July. That's right. If you attend TAM and come on Thursday, July 14th, you could take a workshop on investigating monsters that features the entire cast of Monster Talk. Plus, I think there's going to be some other notable guests and whatnot. I don't know. Come on out, though. We're going to be there. We're talking about getting to shake hands with the trio who brought you the awful truth about how dangerous it is to be an amorous slug. Where else can you get content like that? Well, normally I would just say Monster Talk, but now apparently also TAM. So, I hope to see you there. Now on with the show.
Monster Talk.
All right. You want to talk about Brian Regal's new book?
Yeah. So Searching for Sasquatch, Crackpots, yeah. Eggheads, and Cryptozoology. So, you know, a lot of these books from academic presses are expensive.
Yes.
Tell me about that, Mr. I'm in Publishing.
Well, thank you for asking. As someone who has published with a couple academic presses, most recently, of course, the University of New Mexico Press, which published my book "Tracking the Chupacabra," which is actually one of its best-selling titles for this season, which I'm pleased about.
Cool.
Yes. Well, part of what happens, of course, it's the economics of book publishing. Titles that come from academic presses, such as the one we're going to discuss today, I think it's the Palmgrave Studies in the History of Science and Technology, is the name of the press.
Paulgrave, yeah, Paulgrave Macmillan, yeah.
Paulgrave Macmillan. You know, what happens is there's a bit of a trade-off there because the academic presses tend to be, of course, much more scholarly and academic, and therefore they're much more reliable, but they don't necessarily have the commercial appeal or the push behind it, you know, that you would see with a major, you know, commercial marketer such as, you know, Avon or you know, HarperCollins or what have you. So because they don't expect to sell as many books, they have to price them accordingly. So they do the math on it and they figure, well, we can sell X many books, you know, at this price. But if we don't think we're going to sell that many books, we need to recoup our expenses by jacking up. Well, I don't want to say jacking up, but by increasing the price on the titles.
To cover the price of the print run is what you're saying. So there's some minimum price required for making a run of these hardcover books, and they have to guess on the expectations. They have to make a guess of how many they might sell and then price them according to how much it will cost to cover that on the print run.
That's exactly right. And you know, especially when you're talking about something with a title like, you know, Searching for Sasquatch, it's a great title and it's, you know, it's a fine book. But, you know, the book as it's presented, and I'm looking at it right now, it's an attractive book, but it's not necessarily, you know, going to be a New York Times bestseller no matter what you do with it. So that's sort of tough thing.
It's funny because I'm looking at it. It's a fantastic book. Having read it, it's very academic, and the tone of the book is very academic. It's got references, and the references aren't to monster hunting books. They're to actual published articles and other things.
Or worse yet, the references aren't to their friend's blog.
Right. Hey, I don't think that's hurt your book at all to be referencing my blog. So
I'm just saying.
Right, so the entry price was it 85, I think?
I think 115, wasn't it?
$3,000.
It's fairly expensive.
I'll check it right quick. We'll get it right. Amazon. Brian Regal. Amazon's. Hey, it was $85. It's on sale for $68 at Amazon.
There you go.
I would like to read this book on a Kindle. Actually, you know, I have to say this is, and I know your book just came out on a Kindle as well. Now, all your books are, or your two most recent books are both available on Kindle now.
My two most recent ones.
So, love reading academic books on the Kindle because you can bookmark them and put notes in, share your notes with other people. It's fantastic. So,
cool.
Very fun.
I have to use the old school method of a mechanical pencil 0.05 and writing in the margins.
Yeah, and that's okay too. But then if you want to share them, you have to go photocopy your notes or give your book away. But I was going to say Searching for Sasquatch, also very suitable for Kindle. So hopefully he'll get that out that. No pictures, unlike your two books, which both have lots and lots of photos. But I think they look great on the Kindle, but his book has no photos whatsoever. So
right. And in fact, that's kind of I did notice that and I was somewhat disappointed. I don't know whether that was a publisher's decision or he just couldn't come up with anything for it. But I mean, I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out why there were no pictures in it.
Yeah, we could ask that. Say, why no pictures, Mr. Regal?
I want pictures, Mr. Regal.
Well, I guess it's kind of in keeping with Bigfoot, right?
Right. Exactly. No. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
That's
good. Zing.
Monster Talk.
Before good, we get started, I want to say thanks for coming back and joining us again.
No problem. My pleasure.
All right. I'll do an intro here. And as you may recall, the show is recorded and we do edit it. So if you screw something up, we can, you know, redo it or whatever. So.
Okay. I'll try not to use any bad language.
Yeah. We can beep that out.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. We like it. It's good for the ratings. If you want to do a little nudity, that's okay too.
No, you don't want that.
It's not what I want, Brian. It's what the listeners want.
It's what the people want.
Whatever the market demands, that's what we'll give them.
Right.
Very good.
Brian Regal is an assistant professor for the history of science, technology, and medicine in the Department of History at Keene University. He's a return guest, having joined us before on our very first skeptic-sponsored episode to discuss werewolves and Charles Darwin. And now he's back as the author of the new book, Searching for Sasquatch, Crackpots, Eggheads, and Cryptozoology. All right. So, Brian, your book title sounds somewhat confrontational, which seems at odds with the academic historical tone of the text inside it. So what does that title mean to you?
My original plan for the title was to call it Crackpots and Eggheads, Amateurs, Professionals, and Cryptozoology. But the good people at Palgrave Macmillan thought that this would be a better title, so I went with that. But yeah, it is a little on the controversial side, and I've already been I was told before the book went into production that people would be upset with this, but I forged ahead anyway because I thought it was important, and I don't use those terms in a negative, confrontational way. They're actually sort of I use it in an endearing kind of way. Crackpots, of course, being amateur naturalists, monster enthusiasts, and the eggheads being professional scientists. I actually got the terms from Rennie DeHinden and Ivan Sanderson, so I didn't actually make them up. When I was doing the research for this book, which took me – this is the end of a five-year research project. When I was working on this, when I began working on it, and I was reading all these original texts and letters and diaries and things, and I came across these terms, and all I thought was jackpot. There's my title right there, Crackpots and Eggheads.
There you go.
So that's what I went with.
And so, Brian, how is this book different from a book about the subject of cryptozoology in general?
Well, this is really a history. I think it's the first time, history of cryptozoology. Not cryptozoology broadly, but mostly the part of cryptozoology that deals with man-like monsters, what I like to call anomalous primates. And what I did was, I'm really not interested. This book is not about proving whether Bigfoot does or doesn't exist. It's not a debunking book, but it's not sort of a hagiography either. I wanted to do a scholarly analysis of what I thought was a really interesting field, and see if I could trace where this comes from, how does it begin. And at the heart of it is the crackpots and eggheads concept, is the relationship between amateur naturalists and professional scientists and how they have interacted and sometimes come to blows, sometimes work together in order to create a new field, or at least attempt to create a new field of scientific study.
Well, Brian, I was going to say, having read your book, it was really cool for me to see sort of a broader illustrations of many of the people that I had read about, you know, everybody from Krantz to DeHinden to Tom Slick and all that. So it was. I thought one of the things that your book did really well was sort of flesh out these otherwise sort of dry names in the history of cryptozoology.
Right.
So in your book, you talk about a lot of leaders of the field. Which of those really stood out to you as being the most interesting when you were researching the book?
Well, that's part of the most interesting aspect of this. The book focuses on Grover Krantz, and that's partly because I think he's an important figure in the story of the growth of cryptozoology, but also, quite frankly, for the simple material fact that so much of his material, his letters and diaries and correspondence, are available. The Krantz papers are at the Smithsonian, at the National Anthropological Archive, and when I'm a professional historian, and when I do start a project on someone or some topic, the first thing I ask is, where are the letters? Where are the correspondence? Where are those inside discussions? Where are the notebooks? Where are the copies where people scrawled sort of wacky marginalia in there? That's what I look for. And, well, a few people had tried to do this on a limited basis before. No one had ever really done or attempted to do a major survey of these correspondences. And so that's how Krantz, that's part of the reason why Krantz sort of comes to the fore. But the most disappointing, for me, the most disappointing part of this project was Rennie DeHinden, who is an incredibly interesting character. Unfortunately, his papers are not as available as Krantz's were. My original idea was to run a parallel biography of Krantz and DeHinden. But as I said, the DeHinden papers are out there, But they are in collections and they're in places which I tried to get access to, but was unable to. And so there is a good bit of material on him available through other people's collections. And so I was able to flesh out something of him as a person, but not as much as I would like to have.
And I think you said that most of Krantz's papers are at the Smithsonian, right?
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, Krantz himself is at the Smithsonian. I saw him and his dog.
He left his body to the Smithsonian along with his dog Clyde, and there he's on display. He wanted his skeleton articulated, along with the dog, and put on display, mimicking a photograph of him and his dog, and that's what happened.
That was odd. Last time I was in Washington, D.C., I was there, and I was just looking at it, and I was like, Grover Krantz, where have I heard that name? Like, is that him? And it was in it because I was sitting there looking at it. Yeah, and then it was interesting because I think I was the only person in the room. There were probably a couple dozen people there who knew, you know, about his connection to Bigfoot, because it was right. actually not mentioned on the display.
Right. And, interesting mounting of a human and a dog skeleton together. That's really what's most interesting, I think.
He had bad teeth, by the way.
I just saw that actually covered on an online magazine. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And you can actually see the photo that it's based on and the actual display and a really nice article explaining how it came to be that Grover Krantz was...
Right. I'm not sure if the dog is actually his first dog, Clyde. It might be. I've seen some conflicting... descriptions where it said it was Clyde, and I saw some others where it said no, it was a later dog. But it's an Irish wolfhound, and the dog Clyde was probably his best friend in his whole life. It's a really interesting relationship, and in the book I argue somewhat that Clyde dies around the time that Krantz really sort of becomes immersed in Bigfoot studies, almost to the point where I think that, you know, there was something where he was so attached to this dog and had lost it, now he's going to turn those feelings onto this creature in the woods.
Okay, so your coverage of Krantz in the book's really interesting, and at one point you quote him as saying, "Nobody outclasses me, at least not since Leonardo da Vinci."
Right.
Right. Is it possible that egoism could have put blinders on him when it came to examining disconfirmatory evidence to his theories?
Yeah, what's interesting about him, one of the things which is interesting about him, is that he, early on, by the mid-70s, I think, he has become convinced that Bigfoot's real. And he thinks that it's real because of evidence which, to his mind, he's a trained paleoanthropologist. He goes to UCal Berkeley, which is, you know, a center, and still is a center, a major center of anthropological, paleoanthropological research. So he is schooled in a powerful academic tradition. He's not an amateur by any sense of the, you know, stretch of the imagination. He's a professional scientist. And to his mind, he sees evidence which clinches it for him, particularly the Bossberg prints, the cripple footprints, and then the dermal ridges, and then some other things as well. And once he's made that decision, you know, he just moves forward. And he really doesn't take much... into consideration. I mean, he doesn't believe every single thing he sees. He understands that there's a lot of hoaxing out there and a lot of misidentification, but he thinks there is enough evidence that proves these creatures are real. And he never really looks back.
And so was he ever really challenged by his colleagues?
Well, not really. And that's partly because most of his colleagues don't believe in anything he's doing. He's mostly dismissed by the mainstream.
They were being indulgent of him to some extent, or just ignoring what he was doing?
Some of the people who worked in the department at Washington State University, the anthropology department, had said essentially that, well, you know, Grover's a really good guy, and he's a smart guy and all, but we just sort of, as you said, we just sort of indulge him on this, and we don't really believe this is anything that's there, but he does other good work, so we're willing to overlook the Sasquatch stuff. And he never receives any sort of grants or research money for the Sasquatch work. He pays for all of it out of his own pocket. And there are times where he doesn't get promoted right away. I mean, he eventually makes full professor, but that's after 20 years. That's a long time to wait to become a full professor. And part of the reason that he did finally, right before he retired, part of the reason why he did get promoted was that a young scientist named John Bodley, who started after him, a couple of years after him, they had become friends. And Bodley eventually rose to the rank, became chair of the department, and he really pushed in the mid-90s to get Kranz promoted and managed to get to squeak by, and so he did get promoted. But had Bodley not put in that effort, Kranz would have finished out his days as an associate, not a full professor.
Well, Brent, I'm just realizing that that many of these names are familiar to the four of us, but maybe not necessarily to our listeners. So I'm wondering if you could sort of sketch out or paint a picture of Grover Kranz and DeHinden and maybe Sanderson, just you know, in a couple paragraphs, just for people who aren't familiar with them.
Kranz was a trained paleoanthropologist, PhD in human evolution studies, who joined the faculty of Washington State University in 1968. And he was primarily doing work on Homo erectus fossils. And he had been intrigued by the idea of Bigfoot and Sasquatch for some years and had kind of informally been keeping up on it and collecting information. And then in 1969, there is a sighting in a tiny little town called Bossburg, Washington, up near the Canadian border. And since the campus or the University of Washington State University is at Pullman, Washington, not very far from there, he over the Thanksgiving holiday, he jumps in his car and he drives up there to investigate, and he sees what come to be known as the Cripplefoot tracks. And these were Bigfoot tracks that had some strange kind of anatomical anomalies to them. And it looked to him like one of the creature's feet had been broken at one point and healed badly. And he had done a lot of work on human locomotion and fossil human locomotion and foot structure, foot morphology. And when he looked at these cripplefoot tracks, in his mind he said, no one could possibly hoax this. No one would know to hoax this in the way that it was hoaxed, the way that it looked. And so he said the only other explanation is that it's real. And he becomes a convinced believer that these creatures are real, and he spends the rest of his 30-plus year career trying unsuccessfully to prove they're real and to convince his colleagues that they're real. His primary nemesis was a Swiss-Canadian named René DeHinden, who had been born in Switzerland, had been deposited in an orphanage for a while, managed to get out of the orphanage, saw a series of work farms as a kid. When he came of age, he went off on his own, wandered around post-war Europe for a little while, and eventually immigrated to Canada. And he winds up in British Columbia. And he has very little formal education, yet he's a very naturally intelligent guy, and he sees reports of Sasquatch, which are just starting to sort of get some media play in the 1950s, and he becomes fascinated by it, and he determines to go find out what this thing is. And where Kranz has a lot of formal academic schooling, DeHinden has none, and so these two guys sort of go off on a parallel journey. In the book, I refer to DeHinden as the anti-Kranz. You know, he has no actual scientific training, but he's deeply passionate about this, and they form this kind of love-hate relationship that takes them through the rest of their lives. Kranz dies, I think, a year after DeHinden does, and so that sort of makes up the basis of the book. And then there's other characters like Ivan Sanderson, who was a Scots naturalist, Cambridge-trained. He actually has an undergraduate degree in biology. And he, too, becomes fascinated by these things, and he comes to America and decides to track down these creatures. He's a professional science journalist. He does a lot of writing Sanderson is never an academic, which is part of his resentment of the academic world, because he thought he always should have been an academic, but he spends his life hustling by writing articles and things, a lot of famous articles that are well known in the field. And he too will spend his life trying to prove these creatures are real.
In particular, I thought you did a good job of painting Ivan Sanderson as kind of a tragic figure who gets on this sort of quest to find something that he may never be able to prove. Did you get the impression that at the end of his life he still believed sincerely that these mystery apes were still out there?
Oh, I think they all did. I don't think any of them ever really lost belief that these creatures were real.
I wanted so bad for Ivan Sanderson to have kind of like a paranormal wild kingdom, you know, not paranormal, but, you know, a cryptozoological wild kingdom show. But
right.
He seems such
I'm sure he wanted to.
Yeah. He just comes across as that sort of 50s explorer with the, you know, British accent, putting on the khakis and the pith helmet, and out he goes.
Sure, yeah.
Safari suit.
Right.
Well, all these guys were real characters, and not in a kind of artificial way, but genuine characters, genuinely unusual, interesting people.
So, Brian, one of the most commonly heard claims about cryptozoology is that scientists ignore the arguments and evidence mm-hmm. and dismiss Bigfoot out of hand. Yet your book seems to debunk that myth, as you provide many examples of scientists who did take Bigfoot seriously. Could you talk about that a bit for us?
Oh, sure. One of the other major threads in my book is the within history, we have this notion of the heroic narrative or the grand narrative or the meta narrative, these kind of big ideas, big statements that cover broad fields. And so, you know, if you want to know about something, there's sort of a conventional wisdom says this field is about that. And the heroic narrative of monster hunting, certainly in the 20th century, was that these amateur naturalists, they're the ones who are really passionate about this, and they go around and they do lots of research, and they go out into the field, and they fight against the odds to bring the knowledge of these creatures to the public. And you have scientists who sort of reject all of this out of hand and say, no, this is silly, these monster hunters are just sort of crackpots who don't know what they're doing. They're just running around the woods, and so we dismiss whatever they say. And the reality here is that it's not really quite that easy. There were scientists, and still are, even today, who believe these creatures are real and work to try to prove that. They worked as hard to prove these things real and believed as much as any of the amateurs did. And so this notion that you can draw this nice straight line with, you know, believers and amateurs on one side and non-believers and professional scientists and the mainstream on the other just doesn't really hold up.
In your book, you talk a fair amount about the Russian and the Soviet cryptozoologists who were also mm-hmm. interested in the Yeti and all that. Was there any scientific collaboration going on among the Cold War rivals, or what was the status on that?
Yeah, well, there was. I mean, there's a whole tradition of monster hunting in Russia, the Almasti and the Almas, that are very Bigfoot-like creatures. And a similar kind of pattern developed over there, where you have professional scientists and amateurs interested in this and tracking down information and analyzing data. One of the big differences between the Americans or the Westerners, not just Americans, but the Westerners and the Russians, is that the Russians actually received some state support early on. There was actually a snowman commission in Russia in the 1950s because there had been some sightings by several respected scientists in Soviet Russia. And so as a way of getting at the bottom of this, the Russian government actually put together a snowman commission to investigate the phenomena and to support some expeditions into the Pamir Mountains. it doesn't last that long, because after one or two expeditions and they don't find anything, the Russian government essentially turns their back on it and says, well, that was a big waste of time. And the Snowman Commission is decommissioned, and that sort of leaves the monster enthusiasts on their own to go to their own devices. And that never really happens here. There's really never any official state or academic support for monster hunting in America.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
We've got a podcast recommendation I think will be really fun and or useful for Monster Talk listeners. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast.
Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world of today. For example, migration patterns of dinosaur lineages can tell us about the Earth's changing continents.
Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming.
Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution.
Talk about paleo. In many dinosaur injuries, paleopathologies are the first known occurrences of diseases.
A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, we didn't need it. We had millionaire Tom Slick.
Right, yeah. Well, there was a benefactor involved. The enigmatic Texas oil millionaire Tom Slick, who actually supports, puts up the money for a number of expeditions in Asia to find the Yeti and here in the States to find Bigfoot. And so probably basically would have gone on supporting this had he not died tragically young in a plane crash.
So basically the claim that, again, we sort of touched on this before, but the claim that I sometimes hear that the reason we haven't found better evidence for Bigfoot, for example, is because there's no money behind it or there's no real effort. It doesn't sound like that's quite true.
Well, there has been money behind it. And now today in the early 21st century, you have a number of television shows and TV series that pump money into the search.
Okay.
With the same results.
So there's already this sort of romanticized view of the search for Yeti. You've got skilled mountain climbers coming back with stories. You've got this millionaire. There's a story about Jimmy Stewart being involved in stealing Yeti parts. Your book was the first to ever inform me about the involvement of the CIA in the search for the Yeti. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I'm not actually the first person to talk about this. Lauren Coleman has actually done some work.
Sorry, Lauren.
But there is some really interesting, intriguing intelligence connections here. A number of the what we might call the Golden Age monster hunters, Ivan Sanderson, George Agagino, and Carlton Kuhn, they all had intelligence backgrounds. Agagino was an OSS agent in the Far East. Kuhn was an OSS agent in North Africa. And supposedly Ivan Sanderson had British naval intelligence connections. There had been accusations that Peter Byrne, another one of the grand old men of monster hunting, that he had intelligence connections. It's been alleged that Tom Slick had CIA connections, and that they were contacted, and that when they, especially in the Asia phase, because you have to remember the sort of geopolitical situation that's going on in the 1950s, Tibet and Nepal are right there up next to China, wedged in between India, which was still part of the British Empire, and, you know, the Chinese Revolution had taken place, and they had invaded Tibet, and things were, you know, were really hopping over there. And in the middle of it, there's a monster. And so this is an excuse for Westerners to come looking for this thing. And the Chinese, for example, and the Russians were both convinced that all these guys were spies. The guys on the Western side were convinced that all the Russians who were running around were spies. Everybody seems to have been spying on everybody else. Life magazine was involved. And while I was never able to actually prove one way or another what was happening, it's clear that there was some Western intelligence involvement in the Tibet-Nepal Yeti search.
So these are Bigfoot conspiracy theories, in a sense.
Well, I'm not sure if it really was a conspiracy theory in that it has no basis. I think it does have some basis. I think what happened is these guys had – there's two things going on. You have this group of guys who are genuinely interested in going to Central Asia and proving once and for all that the Yeti exists. They just happen to have – intelligence connections and are going to a place where in the 1950s the U.S. government, the British government, the government of India would be very interested to find out what's going on along the Tibet-China border. And so these elements kind of collide in an almost comical way. There's this odd Russian named Lysanovich who is living in Nepal, who wants to, when he hears about the existence of the Yeti, he wants to get nets in a cage and throw a net over the Yeti and bring him back alive. And Carlton Kuhn wants to do the same thing. And so you have all these guys running around, and they're all spying on each other. And in the end, they don't find anything. So if the U.S. or the U.K. thought that they could get intelligence on China out of these monster hunters, I don't think it really worked.
And how has the search for Bigfoot evolved over the decades in terms of who's looking for them and why and with what tools and methods?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting evolution as well. You start off with these sort of elite monster hunters, these individuals, lone individuals. The guys running around looking for the Yeti in Nepal are mostly professional mountaineers, British mountaineers. And then you get some Americans in there. Peter Byrne, who's Irish, he's in there as well. And then you come, action shifts back to North America, Western Canada, Western United States. And then you get guys like Rennie DeHinden and John Green, a Canadian journalist who gets very interested in all this. And then Tom Slick comes over, and he starts funneling money into the North America search, and he brings Peter Byrne with him. And then that's when Grover Krantz gets involved. But by, say, the mid-1980s, that group – that sort of individual approach begins to wane. In Tibet, you had what I call the mountaineering approach. You have these big groups of people, which is the Yeti searches were modeled on traditional mountain climbing projects, where you have lots of people, porters carrying, you know, like a long line, very romantic scene of a long line of porters heading off into the distance, carrying boxes on their heads, as the group of Western explorers up front leads everything, and that kind of dissipates. They try the expedition approach here in the States for a little while, but that doesn't really work out. And so what happens is it evolves into these sort of lone researchers, maybe in pairs, but never really in large groups, moving around the Pacific Northwest looking for these things. By the 1980s, a kind of new animal comes along, and that's the monster hunting group, and that's a kind of American invention, or American slash Canadian invention, where you have local people. The early guys, the golden age guys, they went wherever the evidence led them. If they had to go to China, they went to China. If they had to go to Tibet, they went to Tibet. They had to go to Canada, you know, wherever they went. But the local guys, which is sort of make up the bulk of monster hunters now, they tended to stay in their own neighborhoods, and they would collect groups of like-minded individuals, and they would search for whatever monster was supposedly located in their area. And then by the end of the century, into the 21st century, you see a kind of resurgence of the elite monster hunter. And English cryptozoologists sort of come back to the forefront. And you have individuals like, say, Richard Freeman, who travels the world in search of cryptids. And they're sort of generalists, where on the American side now, you have people who look just for Bigfoot. And in the English tradition, you have cryptozoologists who look for Loch Ness Monster or Mokilumbembe or Chupacabra or the Orang Pendek. They go where the monsters lead them. And that's sort of the state we're at now. You have these kind of elite, globe-trotting cryptozoologists, and then you have the local groups looking for just their particular monster in their particular neighborhood.
And so where do you think that that's going to lead us? I mean, do you think that the golden age of the of this sort of investigation has died along with Krantz and Slick and Renee, or do you think that there's going to be a resurgence, or what do you think it'll look like, you know, in 20 or 50 years?
Well, most of the elite, what I call the elite monster hunters today, they're certainly characters, but they're not quite the flamboyant characters like the Ivan Sandersons and the Rennie DeHindens. And I mean that in a good way. I don't mean to denigrate them. There's several people doing really good work now. And if anybody's going to find this, you know, prove these things to be real, it'll be them. But they are of a different style, I guess, than the Golden Age guys.
Right, but I guess what I meant was not so much the characters that are looking for them, but in terms of where you think it'll be. I mean, do you think that in 20 years or 100 years people will still be looking for Bigfoot? Do you think that it'll eventually be abandoned if there's no evidence, or what do you think is going to happen with that?
Well, that's prophecy is not really my area, but who knows? I mean, if nothing is ever found, then it may very well just start sort of gradually peter out, and we'll find some other odd thing to look for. But if some of these things ever do turn up to be real, I think that'll give a real resurgence, a real shot in the arm. I think if somebody brought in a Bigfoot carcass tomorrow, there'd be a huge resurgence in individuals. The groups that currently exist would expand and get even more active, and I think a lot more people would get involved in it.
Well, one of the things that jumps out to my mind, you know, just sort of comparing over the history of Bigfoot research specifically, is of course the evolving technology. You have what remains to be the best evidence by many people's estimation of the Patterson film, which of course was shot in 67. And yet these days, you know, cameras are lighter than ever before. They're better than ever before. And so, you know, today's cryptozoologists and monster hunters have far better technology at their disposal. So you would think that would influence the search, right?
You would think. I mean, just as you said, I mean, there's all this technology available, small handheld cameras which give really high-quality footage, yet we still just recently, I think last month, there was some really laughably fake footage came out of a supposed Bigfoot crossing a highway somewhere in the rural South. And, I mean, it's all fuzzy and blurry. If you can't, in the early 21st century, with all this high-tech gadgetry, if you can't get a clear picture of this thing when it's 20 feet away from you, we never will.
Fair enough.
Well, you know, when we had you on before, you talked about the way that the theory of evolution kind of got rid of werewolves.
Right.
So,
well, contributed, not all. Not
well,
all
true, true. Contributed to the demise of, well, as a plausible scenario, right? So, that makes perfect sense. Of course, I mean, you know, history is not prognostication. You know, that it's looking back, not looking forward. I mean, you can make conclusions. I'm not sure. Maybe it's wrong to even ask you how things are going to turn out. I'm interested to see myself, obviously. There's a lot of reasons. I mean, I'll give you an example. Like, some arguments just stay around forever, right? One is Kranz was popular, or Kranz liked to say that you never found the bones of large animals in the forest, which Ben and I looked into, and it turns out you do. And it was
what?
Yeah, I know. It was just interesting. Kranz had some interesting positions. They all did. And these characters, they've done such an interesting job of making high drama out of the search for an animal in the way that some real legitimate scientists looking for lizards won't get. You know, you don't get front page for that kind of thing.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
There's no question there. I'm just making comments. Anyway. But speaking of a big event that did take place, did get a lot of coverage, and things that come up again in conversation, the Minnesota Iceman is mm-hmm. a big case. Now, we've talked about it in an entire show on the Minnesota Iceman. It's a complex story, and we don't have to recount the whole thing here. But in your take on things, what did you think the biggest lesson for the cryptozoology field was from that whole fiasco?
Well, one of the things that I do go on at length about the Minnesota Iceman in the book, and looking at in particular how the Smithsonian Institution reacted to it, and this is another example of this idea that there were scientists who were very interested in this. When Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans, the Belgian cryptozoologist, when they hear about the Iceman, they go and look at it, and they look at it, they see it, they take some pictures, they draw it, and they start telling people about it. And a number of people who had been sort of tangentially involved in the Yeti period, they're now at the Smithsonian. People like Dylan Ripley, who had been an ornithologist, who had also been an OSS man and an Asia specialist. He had been involved in the Yeti hunt. He's now the president of the Smithsonian. And John Napier, who had also been involved in the Yeti stuff, wrote the first academic book on anomalous primates. He's also working at the Smithsonian. A number of other individuals who have Yeti Bigfoot connections are at the Smithsonian. And so they say, well, let's go find out about this. And the Smithsonian rallies the energy of the federal government to go and find this thing. And they say, if it's there, we're going to get it, we're going to bring it back here, and we're going to study it, and that's going to be that. And they're very excited about it, and there is a whole string of internal memos. You see, this is the advantage of the historical approach when you take this position of go look for the paperwork. At the Smithsonian, there's a whole pile of memos and inter-office letters and correspondences where the Smithsonian is a beehive of activity and anticipation over the Minnesota Iceman. They think they're on the verge of finding a real creature. And they finally just decide to go to they're working through Ivan Sanderson because he's made connections with Frank Hansen, the guy who has the Iceman. And Dylan Ripley, the president or the secretary of the Smithsonian, says, I'm just going to go to the source. And he just calls Frank Hansen and he says, dude, you know, we want to see this thing. We'll pay you for it. We'll give you credit for it. And Hansen immediately starts backpedaling like crazy. And say, I don't have it anymore. It's gone. All I have is a fake. And so eventually what happens is the guys at the Smithsonian decide, this thing is a fake. We got fooled. It's a carnival trick that looks really good, but it's not what we think it is. And so they're going to give up on it. And that is, I use that story as an example of why scientists are often and academic institutions are so hesitant to get involved in monster hunting because they want facts. They want evidence. Scholars want the goods. They don't want stories. They don't want, you know, bad video. They want concrete facts. And there were lots and lots, and still are, scientists and other scholars who were perfectly willing to accept these creatures as real, but they wanted to see the facts. And every time they got a fact into a corner, they found out that it was a hoax. And, you know, that can only happen so many times before people decide, you know, I'm not going to – I've spent – you know, an individual might say, I spent 20 years getting my position. I'm not going to risk it by endorsing one of these things and then 2 months later find out it's a fake. Mm-hmm. And so when cryptozoologists complain about how mainstream science won't support what they're doing, this is the reason. Because you can't just bring them nonsense. You have to bring them facts. I know plenty of paleoanthropologists who would kill to get a chance to examine a Bigfoot carcass. They would love it. They look forward to it with great anticipation, but no one's ever bought them one.
I think you make a great point with that, and I'm glad you're pointing that out. One other quick question about the Minnesota Iceman: is there anybody today, even today, that you know of that still believes it was real?
You know, it's one of those things where it was so close. You know, so many people got so excited that this was going to be it, and then it turned out to be nothing. I'm sure there are still people around who think it was real.
Okay. I just didn't know if there's any prominent people.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of, but that doesn't mean there aren't any out there.
So, Brian, what are the main arguments for and against cryptozoology as a legitimate science?
Well, I guess part of the reason when cryptozoologists are asked about this, they often put forward a number of examples, things like the Okapi, a kind of antelope with long horns from Africa and a very interesting striped body pattern, and of course the megamouth shark and the perennial cryptozoology showstopper, the coelacanth. And they say, well, here are examples of animals which were either thought to not exist or were known only from the fossil record, and then bada boom, bada bing, bada bam, they find live ones. The problem with that argument is that cryptozoology had no part in the discovery of those animals. They were all discovered by accident by non-cryptozoologists. The basic definition of what a cryptid is a creature which is a folkloric creature. It's known from folklore. There are local legends or stories or whatever that these things exist, and what you do is you go out and you try to find out whether these stories had basis in reality. The problem with the Okapi and the megamouth shark and the coelacanth, just to name a few examples, is they're not really mythological creatures. They were essentially unknown completely before they were found. So there really was no cryptozoological aspect. Now, the Okapi, I might be wrong on. The Okapi may have had some Western folklore about it, but certainly not the megamouth shark or the coelacanth. They were just discovered. It's one day somebody comes around the corner and bing, there it is. You know, creatures that no one even suspected were there. Cryptids are creatures which are suspected of being there, but which have not yet been proven.
And have any cryptozoologists ever responded to that observation?
Not that I'm aware of. But the pro part of the story is that there are creatures undoubtedly out there that we don't know of. And very, very little time goes by when new organisms are discovered all the time. Insects and birds and flowers and even fairly large-ish animals are still discovered on a fairly regular basis. But nobody gets really quite worked up about them because they don't usually have a popular mythological aspect to them.
I have a question about your book in general. There's one thing that was missing from its 248 pages. There's lots of references. There's lots of notes. But there are no illustrations or photographs. Can you explain what that
That's
is?
That's what everybody complains about.
Yes. And here
those.
It is again.
Bring this thing together. Oh, man, there's no pictures. It's not a coffee table book.
Is that your defense? It's not a coffee table book?
Yeah. Well, the actual answer to that question is I there were lots of pictures I wanted to use. I found a lot of really cool unknown pictures of Grover Krantz that the Smithsonian has, and I found some other things, but there was a certain cost factor that the publishers didn't want to pay for the rights to use them. The image that's on the cover is from my own collection. That's from a Bickerstaff's Boston Almanac from the 1780s, a drawing which looks for all the world like Bigfoot, but it's actually a kind of crude copy of a famous illustration from the pioneering British primatologist Edward Tyson in his book Anatomy of the Pygmies. But when I saw it, I said, "Oh, that's I gotta have that," and so we put it on the cover.
Okay,
because
well,
we have to pay for it.
I'll forgive you for the lack of illustrations because it is a damn fine book. But I
appreciate it.
I wish you had some art in there. Maybe the second edition.
Well, if you do a sequel, I have some really good clear pictures of Bigfoot if you need them.
Okay, great, yeah.
Yeah, and, Ben's and not used to books without pictures.
That's right.
And there were a number of people who originally were going to let me use photographs and artwork, but then changed their minds. So
okay, so we've talked a lot about the people. We've talked a lot about the history. What about, in particular, the skeptics, since this is kind of a show by skeptics? You talk a lot about the position that skeptics take on each of these people's work, and particularly in the Patterson case, for example. You talk about when Greg Long's book came out, how the skeptics dealt with that. Can you talk a little bit about how skepticism has informed or impacted the field of cryptozoology?
Well, I guess it's the thing which you fight against. It's the thing which cryptozoology fights against is skepticism. And it's sort of a tired cliche now, but I think the only way that skepticism is really going to change in any way is you have to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that these things are real. You have to bring in a body, live or dead, and that's the only way we're going to prove that these are real. It's the only way people will begin to believe them. I mean, I know that's a bit pedestrian, but there you are. all the photographs in the world are not going to prove anything. You're not going to convince skeptics. You have to bring in some actual physical body parts. And you don't really need that much. I mean, the Gigantopithecus, which is the animal that Krantz believed that Bigfoot evolved from, is really known by just a very few pieces, no post-cranial material. It's just a few jaws and teeth. Yet it's completely accepted by the paleoanthropological community as having existed.
You know, having known about Roger Patterson and his film and reading both Greg Long's book and your stuff as well, it's my impression that Roger Patterson was kind of a dick. Is that your impression?
Sort of. I'm not sure if he was an angel or an ape, but he wanted to succeed in Hollywood. He wanted to succeed in some way. He was born into a rural background, had joined the U.S. Army, had gone overseas, seen a bit of the world, and he wanted to expand his life beyond the fairly narrow confines of what he had been born into. He was a man with a lot of ambition, and he winds up with this film, and he thinks that is going to sort of take him where he wants to go. Mm-hmm. One of the things that attracted me to this whole field is that these are all tragic guys. In all my writing, from my first book on, I've always been attracted to tragic characters, people who try to prove something that everyone else says can't be proved, or to show something is there that everyone else says is not there. And that's why I start the book off with the line that this is a story about dreams that don't come true.
Mm-hmm.
These are all guys who, and some women too, who put their whole lives into this thing and put all their money down on one throw of the dice and came up, what's the bad one, Snake Eyes? Is Snake Eyes the bad one?
when you
throw dice,
movie anyway.
Whatever the bad one is. And yet, despite everyone telling them that what they're doing is a waste of time, that they're chasing after something which is not there, they don't care. They just plow forward anyway. They are so committed to this. They're so wanting to do this. And in the end, they fail. There is a very popular kind of plot device or narrative in storytelling where you have the hero, the scientist, who spends his life trying to prove that this thing or that thing doesn't exist, and they're ridiculed, and they're told that they're crackpots and they're crazy and they're this and they're that, and on their deathbed they're lying there, and just before they take their last breath, some young acolyte comes bursting in saying, "Professor, they found it. You were right all along. Now everyone knows you were right." And then, the guy dies happy. But this is a story where these guys were literally on their deathbeds, and no one comes bursting in. No one cares. It never gets proven. They go to their graves believing that these things were real, but knowing that no one believed them, that they were real.
We like to ask our guests every time. We've only had two guests repeat so far, but what's your favorite monster?
My favorite? Oh, werewolves, obviously.
Oh, okay, there you go. I didn't remember if we asked you last time or not. We added that question in.
Let's see if you said that last time, then.
We'll go back and check our records.
Yeah, well, they're the great tragic monsters.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think there are werewolves. I want to make that clear. I don't believe there are, actually are werewolves. But, you know, from a mythological point of view, I always sort of sided with the werewolves. Certainly, you know, against the stinking vampires.
They are getting a lot more hot romance book action lately.
Yeah. A lot of teen girls apparently like the idea of a big, muscled, hairy guy.
Yeah, so maybe we should change our question to, are you Team Jacob or Team Edward?
I abstain on such a question.
So, it's not just teen girls, right, Blake?
Right. No. It's not. That, apparently, it's also housewives. So I noticed that when I'm in the romance book. And Blake. Okay, yes. Yes, I read,
come on.
I read vampire romance and and werewolf.
Well, I didn't know about that, but you did. So there you go.
Yeah. So you nailed it. What? Okay.
What she said.
All my, you know, I don't just do academia with my monster research, right? It's
pop culture.
Anyway. Well, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us again, Brian.
It was my pleasure.
We'll cut out the unprofessional parts.
We'll cut out the stupidity.
I didn't really say that.
That's right.
Put it anywhere you want.
All right. It was great talking to you.
Thanks a lot. We'll put a
link
in our show notes, and hopefully you'll have great success with this.
And, I appreciate the time.
And again, thank you so much for being a part of our show.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot. All right.
Bye.
See ya.
Monster Talk.
Monster Talk is proud to be sponsored by Skeptic Magazine. Today's episode was about the history of the hunt for Sasquatch and featured Dr. Brian Regal discussing his newest book, Searching for Sasquatch, a link to which will be in our show notes. I'm Blake Smith, and my co-hosts today were Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolzno. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you for listening.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
I'm going to have to buy a new scale. I got all excited last night. I got on the scale and it said I had weighed 10 pounds less. And I was like, fantastic. And, you know, I'm a skeptic. So I got off the scale and got back on again. And it said, you've lost 10 pounds. I was like, this is fantastic. And I got off again and got back on again. It says, you've lost 5 pounds. And I'm like, you, scale.